there's a huge shortage of specialists, whether you're talking about endocrinology or cardiology. It's really quite dire in something like movement disorders practice for a variety of reasons, but only about 8% of Parkinson's patients this year will get to see a movement disorder specialist.
Wow. So
only about 8% of people with a Parkinson's diagnosis will be able to see a doctor who specializes in treating Parkinson's.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Did you know that neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's are often treated with one-size-fits-all approaches, despite the fact that every patient's experience is unique? Rune Labs is working to change that. I'm Alex Merwin, and I am excited to introduce a new AWS host to the show today, Mike Tarcelli, Specialist Leader, Healthcare and Life Sciences, Data, and Artificial Intelligence at AWS. Longtime listeners may recognize Mike's voice. That's because he used to be the Chief Scientific and Knowledge Officer at Tetra Science and was interviewed on this pod on number 53. So keep tuning in. Perhaps you'll be a host before long. Anyways, Mike will be talking to Brian Pepin, the CEO and founder of Rune Labs, about his background in neuroscience, the company's innovative approach to digital biomarkers, and how they're working to make a difference in the lives of patients with these terrible diseases. Let's dive in and hear more from Brian.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. I'm Mike Tarcelli. Thank you for listening. And today, I have a wonderfully illustrious guest. This is Brian Pepin of Rune Labs. Brian, how are you?
I'm well. Glad to be here, Mike.
Excellent. Brian, you know what? The listeners can't see you or I. They only know you by voice. So tell us about yourself. What's your background as a scientist, and how did you get to be doing this with Rune?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to share my story. So I founded my company called Rune Labs about 6 years ago to kind of try to build the first, call it a precision medicine company in neurodegenerative disease. We focus strongly on Parkinson's, and I think precision medicine, I think right therapy, right patient, right time, using data to drive medication decisions. I was inspired to start the company from a couple different parts of my background. One, before starting the company, I spent about 5 years at Google Health and then Verily doing a lot of diabetes and immuno-oncology related platforms and collaborations. Got that.
Also important diseases, really.
Also important diseases, and got a sense for what's possible, what can be possible when you can connect data with outcomes, when you connect data with medications and things like that. Before that, I had been at Berkeley studying for a PhD in neuroscience. And while I was there, gravitated towards a strong focus to this kind of translational neuroscience, how to use neuroscience insights in humans to treat disease, to treat patients who have been locked in, paralyzed, and things like that. So after spending that time at Verily working in other areas, wanting to get back to my core interest and my roots in the brain, thought there was an incredible opportunity to use some of these modern technologies that have come out on both the sensor side. So we use a lot of stuff, for example, in the Apple Watch and the phone, but also some of the just time processing data tools that are available now to ingest a really large amount of actionable data in the context of a disease like Parkinson's and make a difference. So felt that the timing was right, started the company. Here we are 6 years later on this podcast.
That's really cool. That's amazing and inspiring. And if it makes you feel any better from a personal side, I too have some relatives in my family who have had Parkinsonian dementia-like phenotypes. So I appreciate the work you guys are doing. Thank you.
Yeah, it is the fastest growing by percentage diagnosis disorder, neurodegenerative disorder in the US. It's behind only Alzheimer's in terms of the number of patients it affects. So pretty common for the people that I know in my life that I talk to have a family member, to have a friend that was affected. So yeah, it feels like a very impactful area to be working right now.
Very much so. I'd love you to tell me, before you share a little bit about what Rune Labs is doing now in the space, perhaps you can tell me more generally, what's a digital biomarker? What does it do? And how do you get it involved in the medical treatment regimen?
Yeah, that's a big question. I can tell you maybe just speaking from my experience, what it means for us and what it means in our context. So there are a lot of things that are done clinically, scales that are administered. Somebody might ask you a question, how do you feel on a scale of 1 to 5? How much pain are you in? They might observe your movement and then rate it on a scale of 1 to 4, how slow you are or something like that. And I think the simplest way to think about a digital biomarker is taking that very subjective, very analog thing and quantifying it, and quantifying in a way that's repeatable, that's consistently measurable, using a standardized sensing approach, a standardized data format, standardized output, where you can compare many different trials, many patients, apple to apples, and doing that in a way that the FDA, the regulators, everyone accepts is, okay, this is an as good, if not better way to understand disease progression, to understand effects of medications, et cetera, versus the previous standard of care, which was a sort of subjectively administered clinical scale. So I think there are lots of opportunities to do that in a range of fields, but there's a really large number of these opportunities in somewhere like neurology, where there is not a history of quantitative blood-based biomarkers. There's not a history, like in cardiology necessarily, of reading somebody's EKG chart. It really is walking into a clinical office, getting poked and prodded and observed by a neurologist, and coming away with, in best case scenario, coming away with a number between 0 and 4 of where you are on the scales. There are some low-hanging fruit, but also because you're starting from that point, there are some challenges too. But that's a lot of the areas where we focus. We're taking these things which have historically been clinically intensive, labor intensive, subjective to administer, and figuring out ways to digitize them and do that in a way, hopefully, that's pretty low burden for not only the clinicians, but the patients to be able to get this data about themselves. Yeah.
I understand. As a person who's lived through neurology consults before myself, I do understand the poking and prodding and the being told, can you feel this? Can you feel that? What about that? So yes, good to see that's being rendered more quantitative. I see that one of your core offerings is Strive PD. And being honest, I know only what I've read. So I'd love to hear from the horse's mouth, as it were, what is Strive PD and what are you trying to do with it for Parkinsonian patients?
Yeah, our best analogy for what Strive PD is that some of your listeners might be familiar with is the kind of classic concept of a dopamine management system in diabetes. So something like a continuous glucose monitor or a blood glucose monitor, maybe with an insulin pump, maybe with just normal kind of insulin injections, but basically a way for, in the context of diabetes, those systems help people with diabetes manage their insulin at home and keep themselves in range so they can stay healthy, so they can not put too much stress on their pancreas, so they can keep from bad outcomes. And what we do in Parkinson's is not only quite similar, except for the thing that we care about is this dopamine load in the brain. So a lot of the symptoms of Parkinson's are related to the death of dopaminergic neurons in the brain. And a lot of the therapies indirectly or directly modify that kind of dopamine load, but it can be very complex. There's a lot of variation that happens within a day-to-day diet, sleep, exercise. All of these things can affect how your brain and your body are responding to these meds. So because we have the ability through some technology that we built on top of Apple's HealthKit ecosystem and their Apple launch to automatically classify and detect common Parkinson's symptoms around gait, around tremor, around dyskinesia, we can collect that data real time, put it in the context for a patient with their medications, with other things that might affect that, and allow patients to match patterns and get insights that can help them make small adjustments, that can help them make larger adjustments, that can help them understand actions they may want to take, small ones, for example, around exercise or diet, larger ones, maybe around seeing a physiotherapist or trying to get that next appointment with a specialist. And that's hopefully just the beginning, but that's where we're at right now, is this sort of very kind of patient-centric, giving and really empowering folks to have some visibility into what's going on, using some artificial intelligence to strip away the noise and help patients focus on the key patterns that they can affect. And yeah, and we deployed that in a couple different ways. But one of the nice things about being able to leverage building on top of Apple's ecosystem and also building on top of Amazon's ecosystem is that we've been able to just deploy it at a pretty wide scale through the App Store and through AWS. We're working now with, I think, over 12,000 patients. We're at 250 clinics around the U.S., starting to look at expanding more seriously internationally. But we're really a software and data company. We haven't had to go and build our own brand new medical device, for example, to get all this out to people.
No continuous dopamine monitor yet that plugs into your arm or your skull.
Yeah, the nice thing is because in Parkinson's in particular, like we're looking at your movement symptoms and predicting how much dopamine is in your brain. And that hopefully is getting better and better over time and more accurate. So we're able to provide more directed feedback to the patient on what to do.
Brian, can you tell me a little bit about what kind of feedback you've gotten either from the patient side of users of the app or from clinicians, pharmacists, neurologists, someone who's used it as a, I don't want to say customer, but someone who's used it in a clinical practice. What do either of those two groups say with the app?
Yeah, my favorite feedback is always the feedback from patients and people who care for patients, the spouse, the adult child who's caring for their dad with Parkinson's. A lot of the feedback has a flavor of, there's two maybe buckets. One is, a lot of the feedback is like very tactical. It's, I've been trying to do this. I've been trying to figure out my exercise. I've been trying to figure out this afternoon medication. I've been trying to do this. I tried to solve this problem with my clinician for years and we couldn't figure it out because the problems I'm having never replicated in the clinic. And I was finally able to figure it out with your platform.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. And then the other kind of bucket of feedback from patients is a little bit more existential somehow. Like it's more of, my relationship with my disease is just so much different now that maybe I thought was only in my head is now visible and I can communicate about it, understand it. Or I had been so stressed out of having to keep track of all this stuff and now it's just all done automatically for me and put into context. So just reducing that cognitive load and cognitive burden.
Mental burden. Yeah.
I think that's part of it too. On the kind of clinician side, I think this happens for every specialty right now, but there are not enough specialists. There's a huge shortage of specialists, whether you're talking about endocrinology or cardiology. It's really quite dire in something like movement disorders practice for a variety of reasons, but only about 8% of Parkinson's patients this year will get to see a movement disorder specialist.
Wow.
So only about 8% of people with a Parkinson's diagnosis will be able to see a doctor who specializes in treating Parkinson's. And that, for a movement disorder specialist, creates a lot of discomfort because they got in the field to help as many people as possible. And so I think the feedback we get from them is, you know, this is great. I can't see everybody I want to see, but if I empower you guys to go out and work with folks, then at least I know that you're able to close some of these gaps. Maybe you're able to help alert me if there's a particularly risky patient that I do need to see. And instead of somebody having to wait 6 months to see me and getting worse, maybe there's some things that you can do with them on demand that are going to really help them out in the meantime. And maybe hopefully keep them out of the emergency room, right? Keep them from getting into a place where they fall or, you know, take too much dopamine and pass out or something like that. So,
you're a scale vector. You're a scale vector to augment their practice.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really great. Yeah. That's awesome. Tell me a little bit about how you collaborate, if you do at this current time, with pharma companies, biotech companies, or other provider companies on the other side, on the sort of tech side, in these therapy developments.
Yeah. So I'm not totally sure where I'm meeting your listeners. The big problem for neurology drugs and Parkinson's drugs and the pharma side right now is that there are no disease modifying drugs available. There's a lot of drugs that sort of modify symptoms, but none that actually modify the disease. And this is the holy grail of Parkinson's drug development. This is what every big pharma company, every biotech that's working on Parkinson's drugs right now is trying to do. And in order to get a drug approved, you have to run what's called a phase 3 trial, which is a trial that shows with a high degree of statistical certainty to the regulators and to the payer authorities that your drug works. In this case, you want to be able to say that your drug is modifying Parkinson's disease in these patients. And it turns out that the only thing that you have as a measure is like a subjective scale. it's really hard to run that trial. You need a lot of patience, a lot of time, because those scales are noisy.
How does the drug feel 1 to 5?
That's very hard.
Right.
And then if you're asking somebody, depending on what time of the day you're asking them, you might get a different answer. And so there's been a lot of failed trials. There's been a lot of, and now what you're at the point of where pharma companies are almost reluctant to run these things because they're so worried that they're going to fail. And so our role fundamentally is to go in with a different way of measuring symptoms, but also a different way of, because we have so much access to this real world data of what's happening with patients and how they progress along these different axes, really a different kind of way of designing trials where you're able to screen patients differently, where you're able to do more sophisticated trial designs with kind of interim analysis points, and ultimately where you're able to just have better, more sensitive endpoints so that you can take a drug that's promising, but economically doesn't pencil out to run a phase 3 trial right now. And you can make it economically pencil out to run that trial and hopefully have it succeed, right?
The most targeted patient population you can get with the better responders and the better measurement.
That's, I think, fundamentally our role is to really shift the economics around these phase 3 trials. And there's a lot of ways in which we do that with our data and our network, but that's the point of us in engaging with these pharmaceutical companies.
That's really amazing. You mentioned AI a little earlier, and I understand it's a little bit buzzword right now, but there are real practical introductions of the technology into our daily lives. And of course, Drive PD and Bruin Labs is no exception. So how do you see AI generally? Remove yourself first from Roof Labs for a minute and say, how do you see it evolving just for neurology and neurological diseases writ large?
Yeah. So there's two areas where we use it. And I think there are other people that are using it in quite a similar way. So there's which had been a lot of what was going on maybe over the previous 5-6 years, applications of classical machine learning approaches to big data problems in neurology. So that's happening on the imaging side. We had been using a lot of that on like very dense time series data streams to pull out patterns in the data that were predictive around certain medications, or that maybe were predictive of if somebody was about to have a major progression event or be a risk event. And those continue to be quite helpful, especially when you're in a position like we are, where you're able to collect a lot of multimodal, very dense time series data about somebody, where you have a useful label. Oh, we know when this person took this medication, or when this person fell, or we know these things. You can pretty quickly, because you have so much data, you can pretty quickly get to the ability to make predictions that are useful for folks. And we've been applying those. Other people have been applying those. More recently, we've, in the context of what we're doing, both for patients and their clinicians, been getting a lot of leverage out of the large language models, because they're just so good at being able to ingest a bunch of, in our case, we feed time series data in, but also like unstructured nodes, also context from maybe somebody's notes in the app, or even in some cases, like these larger programs that we work at with Kaiser and others, like medical records. And we're able to take a large language model, which has been constrained and trained with some additional data, for example, from UCSF and the Parkinson's Foundation and Care Things. And all of a sudden, on demand, patients can get in context feedback for their symptoms and their medications. That's the equivalent of having a really highly qualified like patient coach go through that data with them. And they don't have to wait for an appointment. They don't have to be on Zoom for 30 minutes. They just click a button and get the feedback. And that's something I truly do not think would have been possible even a year ago. And it's a nice thing for us, because that part of the product gets better right now about every 6 months when people update their models. Very exciting to see where that's going to go. And that feeds right into this kind of like labor shortage thing I was talking about earlier too, which is in the further, the more you amplify the effects that of the clinicians out in the world.
Understood. No, that's amazing. I'll ask, of course, we have to, because if the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, how has AWS helped you to date along your journey as Rune Labs and then into the future of where you're going to go in the next year?
Yeah. I think there's a couple ways. One, maybe which I anticipated going in, and one which I didn't. I'd used AWS a lot coming into this journey and knew it could scale and knew that it could solve a lot of the problems that we wanted to solve on the machine learning side through kind of
pretty straightforward applications of EC2 and SageMaker and some of these things, which build up as well as some of the newer products in the time series side that Amazon offers. So I think that's been great. The other thing, which maybe I underappreciated going into it, is how much of Amazon's infrastructure can basically be HIPAA compliant right out of the box.
Yes.
And that is great. We thought we were going to have to do all of this work. My team did going into this company, and we were happily surprised that being HIPAA compliant on the cloud side was like the easiest thing that we ever had to solve. And anytime we've been in, we work with Kaiser, we've worked with large pharmaceutical companies who do data security audits. And anytime we've had to show, hey, we're HIPAA compliant, it's been that part of it. Anything involving AWS has been super easy. And it's just nice not to have to worry about that. So
we often say security is job zero around these parts. And yeah. I would add to that, compliance is job zero as well, because you really have to have those. It's a non-negotiable starter. Thank you for that. One other quick thing is simply, you are a founder. You've run a successful company. You're obviously making gains for patients around the world. What would you say if someone were just coming out of grad school or just getting their first seed round going? What would you tell that life sciences or health tech startup founder now?
Yeah, I think maybe a couple things. One is make sure you're very clear about what risk you're trying to take and try to only take one big one at a time. In previous lives, I've been part of projects and I see folks get into projects where maybe they're trying at the same time to take like a major scientific risk, a major clinical risk, and like a major business model risk.
Okay,
that's a lot of risk, even for the venture world. Or maybe sometimes even worse is people think they're taking a scientific risk, but actually they're taking a big business model risk. And then they're putting all this work towards de-risking the thing that's not really what they need to be de-risking. Yeah, I think it behooves everybody to go into it eyes wide open, be very clear about what the main risk is. That's the one you're going to take. That's the one you're going to knock down. You can be clear with yourself, your team, your investors. That's going to help you go far. I think the other one, to the extent that you have this luxury, hopefully you do, is you want to make sure that if you're getting into a project and you're picking that early team, and especially those kind of early investors, that they buy into the long vision. Because healthcare, there is no overnight success in healthcare. It's not a short cycle by any stretch of the imagination. You need to be committed to your idea for 10 years. Maybe you'll get lucky and you have an exit in 6 to 7 years. But there is no, you start this company and a year later you IPO in healthcare. So you got to really yourself, your early team, your investors all be committed for a longer haul. And if you can figure that out, then again, you're setting yourself up for a higher degree of success.
That's really sage advice and I appreciate it. Any closing thoughts or anything you'd like to communicate out to the audience we haven't covered here?
No, man, I think it is especially around anything that helps augment this kind of capacity for clinicians. Really exciting time to be building in healthcare because there are some new tools available and some new kind of a new regulatory environment. There was a very important piece of legislation passed several years ago called the 21st Century Cures Act, which empowers patients to be in control of their own medical records. Which is great because if you're a cardiology company or a diabetes company or a Parkinson's company working with a patient, they are empowered to share as much data with you as is helpful for that condition. And no healthcare system, no EHR provider or whatever can block you. And there's increasingly, and Amazon's been a huge part of this, increasingly reduced friction in the ability to access, work with that, read, write.
So we're here to help. We'd love your data. Right.
The combination of like access to that data with the ability to use, you know, these classic machine learning tools, these modern LLM tools to make sense of it is, yep. And it's just very exciting. Like I was at Verily, which was like the epicenter of healthcare technology for a little while, not that long ago. And I don't think anybody at Verily exactly predicted that we would already be where we are today in terms of the ability to build some of these products. So really fun time to be building in healthcare.
That's great. Brian Pepin, thank you very much for joining us on the AWS Health Innovations Podcast. We appreciate your time, sir.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.